please. Also ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
Chief Justice Moon and members of the court, may it please the court, my name is Terry Revere and Ms. Zooks, and I represent the petitioners in this appeal, Mr. and Mrs. Alvarez and their family trust. If I may, we did bring copies of Robert's Rules of Order, which we provided to counsel beforehand, and it is, Roberts is part of the Hawaii condo statutes because the statutes require all condo board meetings to be done pursuant to Roberts. So with the court's permission, we'd like to provide a copy to the justices.
Any objections? All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yes.
Thank you.
This case involves two principal issues. There's a what I believe is a fairly straightforward voting issue about what do you do with abstentions under the bylaws at issue. And the second issue is the interpretation of HRS 514C, which is a statute that's very unique to Hawaii because it deals with a very uniquely Hawaii problem of leasehold land in residential real estate. And I believe that there's only one Hawaii case that's dealt with the statutes in any way, which is the Ma'alaya Kai case. Briefly, the Ka'anapali Ali'i, which is the condominium in question, is a 264-unit condo on Maui, and all but 68 of the 264 units were held in fee in 2003 at the time of the underlying facts. So only 25% of the association's common interest was held in leasehold. The owner of those leasehold interests was a Japanese developer named Omori. And in 2003, they wanted to divest themselves of their Hawaii assets, including the fee interest under these 68 units. The AOAO learned of this, and the AOAO passed a motion where they appointed a former board member, Mr. Bill Fontana, and the motion read as follows, that Mr. Fontana and a committee that he was supposed to head was to, quote, work with Hawaii Omori and its agents together with our board of directors to obtain the lease to fee interest on behalf of the individual unit owners who have not purchased their fee interest. And that happened in July of 2003. And at that point, I would respectfully submit the association is doing what it's supposed to do as fiduciaries and under 514C. Then things go off track. Instead of Mr. Fontana, instead of obtaining the fee interest on behalf of the leasehold owners, as he was directed to do under this motion that was passed, he forms an LLC for himself. He then gets the board president and a few other owners to invest as investors in this for-profit LLC, and they make an offer to Omori to obtain the fee interest. This comes out in the October board meeting, which is the next board meeting, and one of the board members that wasn't involved in this scenario, Mr. Dunyan, points out that Mr. Gordon and Mr. Fontana planned on making a $4 million profit by buying these fees in bulk and selling them at retail prices to the lessee owners. So there's an uproar over this, understandably. And then eventually this LLC called Nohea Kai withdraws its offer eventually down the road. Because of this confusion of the board committee chairman and the board president forming their own private LLC, there's some confusion. So what the association does is they send out a single ballot question initially that says, owners, do you approve of us doing a right of first refusal type of purchase or a voluntary sale? And it's on one line, so it's not like you could say, no, I don't want a right of first refusal, but I do want a voluntary sale. It's all on one ballot. And the amounts that that so in any event, this gets passed by the owners, and then the board has a vote to set the pricing policy. And the board passes a, or the board attempts to pass a motion, which would have allowed, which would have put the leasehold owners in a worse position than they ever would have been if the association never got involved. They plan on making $47,000 roughly per profit per unit. They also had to pay closing costs and basically bear all the risk of the of these sales. And also there's a built-in lockstep 5% increase that the board approved, even though, as we know from today's economy, prices go down as well as up. So in any event, this is brought, this motion is brought, and the bylaws of this, and this is the critical thing for this part of the case, the bylaws require a majority vote of the board members who are present. And what happens is two board members out of seven, all seven are present at this meeting. There's seven board members, all seven are there. Two board members abstain. Two board members vote against the pricing policy. Three board members vote in favor of the pricing policy. And one of those three, by the way, was Mr. Gordon, the board president, who was an investor in this LLC that was trying to step between the fee owner and the homeowners. The bylaws require a vote of the majority of those present, and that simply didn't happen. Four voted to either abstain or against this pricing policy. With regard to this first issue, Robert's Rules of Order is very, very clear on what to do in a situation where what you need is a vote of the majority of those present. Unfortunately, the ICA relied upon the basic rule, which says you just count those present and voting. And on page 2 and 3 of the ICA's opinion, that's what they said that they were relying upon, and that is the pink tab on the Roberts that we provided to the court. The problem is that they looked at, with all due respect, the wrong page. The yellow color tab that we have, which is page 389 and 390, that is the part that talks about what you do in the case where you have a set number, such as the all of those present. And on page 390, Roberts writes, abstention in such cases has the same effect as a negative vote. The Roberts has an official website for frequently asked questions, and this is number 6, so this question, I guess, must come up a lot, and they explain it all out there. Say, yes, generally, abstentions don't affect the results. However, in situations where you need a majority of those present or a majority of the entire body, it does affect the result. The association, the respondent here, in their opposition to our motion for writ, they don't even adopt the ICA's opinion. Mr. Tsukazaki will speak for himself, but I think they acknowledge the ICA just has the wrong page. Instead, the association makes a new argument. They say, well, if you're abstaining, then you're not really present. And with due respect, that's not correct under the section that we just cited, and it's also not correct under page 406 of Roberts, which says, if you want to abstain, what you are supposed to say is, what it reads is, if he does not wish to vote, he answers present or abstain. So they're equating the two. And the association has cited no authority to counter what Robert says, and we believe that's dispositive since that is the controlling authority. We also cited to the ICA the Hawaii Electric versus DLNR case, which is 102 Hawaii 257. This was not addressed at all by the ICA. And again, we believe it's directly on point because it's a Hawaii case that deals with what do we do with abstentions, vacancies, et cetera. And then this court in the Hawaiian Electric Light Company case voted to reaffirm a case called Limer versus Kumalai, which is 29 Hawaii 392. Which said that the number needed where the vote is a majority vote of the body is not affected by abstention, resignation, or vacancy. The AOA's only way to distinguish that case is say, well, that was a public case involving DLNR, and this is a private case involving a homeowners association. But I believe that's a distinction without a difference. The both of these cases were controlled by the statute. Here the statutes require them to follow Robert, and their own bylaws state what is supposed to happen here. And we respectfully submit that just saying, well, one's governmental, one's private, doesn't matter. They both have a specific rule that modifies the general rule about just counting those that are present and voting. Also, the third vote, what the AOAO is deciding, in their mind, deciding vote, was Mr. Gordon. And Mr. Gordon had a very, very clear conflict of interest. He and his friend, Mr. Fontana, were trying to get these fee interests for themselves. The AOAO denies this, but there's an AOAO whistleblowing board member pointing out, hey, you guys are trying to make a $4 million profit. And we've cited that in our brief. So that vote was clearly tainted, and it never should have, he never should have voted. And in fact, he stated he wasn't going to vote on this. The AOAO's attorney, Ms. Neely, said he does have a conflict, he's not going to vote on it, and then he casts what they believe is the deciding vote. So for that reason alone, the voting issue should go in my client's favor. Turning to the 514C issue, the purpose of this statute...
Before you get to that,
sure.
Mr. Revere, as far as Mr. Gordon is concerned, when the vote was taken on the pricing policy, he at that point, or the company, Nohea Kai, had no interest at all at that point, right? It had withdrawn its offer to purchase the lease fee interest.
That is correct, Your Honor. I believe, though, that he, Nohea Kai, I believe you're right, didn't have an interest. I think he still had an interest because what they were sending out to the owner saying, well, lessee owners, we're going to get these fees on your behalf. Then he got it on his own behalf. Owners, at that point, both fee owners and lessee owners were upset, and he had a very keen interest in saying, well, yeah, I was trying to get this $3.5 to $4 million with these other investors in this LLC, so now I will cut basically the rest of the fee owners in on it. So I still believe that he did have a conflict at the
time. What would be the conflict? If he were an investor in Nohea Kai, and Nohea Kai had, prior to the vote on the pricing policy, withdrawn its offer to purchase the lease fee interest, then Nohea Kai would be out of the picture, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would.
And his conflict would be as an investor in Nohea Kai.
He would have that conflict, but I believe that he had a conflict because basically what he was doing, forgetting about my clients and the leasehold owners and the motion that they passed where they said that they were going to get it, he was taking an opportunity from even the AOAO by doing that. And he had an interest in saying, yeah, I'm going to vote on a pricing policy that maximizes the value for the fee owners so that these fee owners are not angry with me. But I agree with you that, is it as clear a conflict? No, it's not as clear as if he was going to benefit from it. I agree.
Mr. Revere.
Yes, Your Honor.
Assuming that we were to agree with you on your position concerning the vote, the trial court also held that you, the petitioners, were stopped.
Oh, that's an excellent point.
And you didn't raise this on appeal.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that there's several things going on here. As far as the trial court ruled that we were stopped because we are voting for basically allowing the association to get this. We couldn't be stopped on the vote of the pricing policy because, and my clients have never objected to letting the AOAO obtain these fee interests. We wanted the AOAO to have these fee interests. But there was no estoppel because we, as far as the pricing policy was
so
concerned.
You maintain that the trial judge was wrong?
Oh, yes, very much.
But you didn't raise that on appeal as an issue.
Well, where they ruled that we were, I don't believe that that's what the trial judge ruled. The trial judge ruled that we didn't raise any objection to the AOAO getting these fee interests. But as far as the pricing policy, we very clearly objected, you know, all the way through.
What was the judge's specific ruling on estoppel? What did he state?
Mm-hmm. Well, Your Honor, in the fifth, and this is attached as Exhibit A to our opening brief, in the fifth finding, I guess, it said the Alvarez had voted in favor of the amendment to the declaration and are stopped from the association's exercise of the right of first refusal and the adoption of its current pricing policy as authorized by the amended declaration and as approved by the board. The problem is, during that vote, there was nothing about this is what we are going to do.
I understand what you're saying. I understand what your position is now, but my question is, why didn't you raise that? Because he indicated that you were a stop on the issue of the pricing policy.
All right. Your Honor, I think that we did appeal from both this ruling denying our motion for summary judgment, and this was in response to our motion for summary judgment. We also appealed their motion for summary judgment and the final judgment, which
in accordance with the rules of appellate procedure, Rule 28, where you're supposed to specifically set forth challenging conclusions of law, we don't see that.
Okay. Well,
so my question, and I'm concerned about that, that you essentially not raising it, we don't have to address it.
Well,
it's binding any conclusions of law then, not challenges binding on the court.
Well, Your Honor, I appreciate that concern, and the only thing I can say to Your Honor is that I hate to retreat to a plain error, but this is, I think, a very plain error. And if the underlying thing, which is the pricing policy, simply did not pass, which we very, very clearly did challenge, I just don't think that the estoppel, that we even get to the second base of it, because we're challenging what happened first, which is this pricing policy didn't pass. But I do believe also it would be plain error as well, Your Honor.
So you're relying on plain error?
If that's the way that the court is ruling, viewing it, then yes, we are, Your Honor. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Revere, if you read paragraph 5, that in and of itself is not clear, is it, as to whether or not the court is ruling that you are stopped from challenging the vote itself?
That's how I read it.
In fact, the court relies on the amendment to the declaration.
Right.
And the amendment to the declaration simply says that the board of directors has a discretion to set the prices for these lease fee terms.
Correct.
And so the pricing policy in and of itself was never mentioned in the declaration.
In this order? Yes. Oh, in the declaration to amendment. You're correct, Your Honor.
And the respondent cites to Godoy. You're familiar with Godoy?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what does Godoy hold?
It's a, I'm not sure for what proposition, Your Honor.
Well, what do you recall of Godoy?
Well, basically, it's a can't blow both hot and cold type of case is how I would think of it.
Well, Godoy holds that if a action violates the law, then estoppel doesn't apply, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's correct, Your Honor. And I think that that's just approving they have the discretion. It's still discretion within the law. I mean, it's not, unfettered discretion, and I agree.
And the respondent in this case never raised any objection based on the fact that you didn't appeal the so-called pricing policy in terms of the estoppel issue. In other words, let me rephrase that. The respondent in this case never argued that you were estopped from, that you failed to raise on appeal estoppel based on the pricing policy.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
And it didn't, because nobody viewed this ruling by the court as pertaining to the vote itself.
That's correct.
But in fact, you argued the vote.
Right.
And the respondent referred and argued in opposition to your position.
That's correct.
And so, and the ICA decided the vote issue.
Yes.
And so the ICA never raised that estoppel, or the fact that the estoppel ruling by the court reached the voting issue.
That's correct.
So if we were to hold that the estoppel doctrine in this case prevented you from raising and prevented the respondent from responding on the vote issue, then in effect estoppel would be used as a way to violate the statute. The statute requiring that you follow Robert's rules.
I believe so. Very briefly, so I'm not sure how much time I have left, probably not much. The 514C issue, the thing that is really, really, really critical, I think, is that we argue the plain language, and there's two parts since they amended it in 2002 of this statute. Part one deals with these, what they call right of first refusal, and part two is these voluntary sales. Our position is whether you look at this under part one or you look at this under part two, they all lead to the same thing, which is that the costs, the expenses, the loans, the realtor fees, all those things the lessee owners have to pay for. But the statute very clearly in part one says that you can charge those lessee owners for the expenses incurred. It doesn't say, oh yeah, and you can mark this up at a big profit. And part two is even more clear in 514C-22, which deals explicitly with this situation. What do we do when there's some fee owners and some leasehold owners? And what 514C-22 says is all benefits and all burdens go to those leasehold owners. And I, like I said, I don't believe it matters whether we're under part one or part two. The AOAO knows that under part two, due to the very explicit language, that what happened here shouldn't have happened here. And I think that, as often happens, both attorneys are saying, well, the plain language is in our favor. We are also arguing, not only is the plain language in our favor, but if there's any doubt, to please look at the legislative history, because what the legislature was trying to deal with here is they had a uniquely Hawaii problem, which is we got a lot of leasehold land. And they wanted to encourage these fee owners sell it to, in a bulk, to apartment owners. And what they use, this is their words, not my words, they said that there's a problem. The problem out there is what they called the middleman. They even called it like a highwayman, which I guess is like Old West type highwayman, would go to large landowners like Kamehameha Schools, Bishop Estate, or big developers and say, I'll buy all these things in bulk from you. I will then turn around and sell them at a profit to these apartment owners. This is the very thing that the legislature thought, we don't like this. We want to have a win-win, win for the large landowner slash developers and for these apartment owners. We don't want, quote, middlemen, and they call them cream skimmers, jumping there in between there. And what they said was the AOAOs are going to act as basically the negotiators and the champions for these guys. What happened here is the complete opposite of what this statute is intended to do. What these guys did here is say, yeah, we don't want that outside middleman skimming all the profits. Us, the fee owners in this condo, we're going to skim all the profits. And one point I'd like to make about, they keep on saying this is a part two right of first refusal. It's not. The ballot that they picked had owners ask for both, approve a right of first refusal and approve a voluntary sale. And what this court said in the Ma'alaya Kai case versus Stilson is correct, which is in order to get under that part one, you need 75% of lessee owners who own 75% of the common interest to approve this part one type sale. That couldn't
Mr.
happen.
Revere, yes. In footnote 12 on page 5 of the answering brief, they say you don't object to and don't challenge the board's authority to acquire the lease fee interest. Is that correct?
I don't challenge it under a voluntary sale, which is what we submit. The only thing that could be because they don't have 75% of the common interest held by lessee owners under 514C6, which is a key provision of part one. they don't have that.
Under the voluntary version, though, you would need 75% of the remaining lessees to approve the acquisition of the lease fee interest, and that wasn't obtained, isn't that correct?
That was obtained in that first vote where they put two lines on the same ballot. Yes, it was, Your Honor. I'm not sure if there's any other questions, but I'd like to save my time for rebuttal if I may. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I would like to address some of the questions the court had of Mr. Revere, particularly regarding the bylaws and how the voting went on the purchase pricing policy. Very simply, what is ignored is there is a specific section in the bylaws, Article 4, Section 11, that specifically provides that for conflicted directors, they may not cast a vote on the matter in which they have a conflict. The Roberts Rules of Order, relied upon by appellants, has within it sections that say that the parliamentary rules in Roberts Rules are superseded by special rules in the governing documents, the bylaws of the associations. In this particular case, there were two directors who, one, recognized on their own voluntarily that they had a conflict. They recused themselves from voting. The directors, the remaining directors, recognized the conflict and voted on the pricing policy in accordance with Article 4, Section 11, that provides conflicted directors cannot vote. The only way you interpret that section with the section requiring a majority vote of the members present is that the members at that point present and eligible to vote are the five remaining directors. This complies with the bylaws. As Robert Rules of Orders, page 16, line 8 to 14, makes it very clear, the governing documents supersede what's in Robert's Rules of Order. As to whether or not Director Gordon had a conflict, appellants misstate the record. The comment regarding Mr. Gordon and a conflict that he held concerned the creation of Nohea Kai. And again, here, the record is misstated. Mr. Gordon reported to the board his contact from the former director, William Fontana. Mr. Gordon informed the board he was contacted because a company was created by Mr. Fontana called Nohea Kai to basically make sure that the association would have a right of first refusal to that property. It was learned that there was another third party who had submitted an offer to buy the remaining 68 lease fee interest. When Director Gordon reported the conflict to the board by motion passed a motion that they would submit the question as to whether or not the association should acquire the remaining 68 lease fee interest by the right of first refusal. The board passed that motion. Director Gordon did not vote on that motion because he recused himself because of that initial conflict. Once that issue went to the entire membership, the membership voted on to exercise the right of first refusal. An affirmative vote of owners representing more than 75% of the common interest voted on that. At that point in time, once the vote was received, there was no conflict because now the association was the party that would be purchasing the right of the remaining 68 lease fee interest under the right of first refusal. So at the time that the pricing policy came up, there was no conflict between Director Gordon and the issue at that moment in time before the board, which is what to set the pricing policy for. At that point in time, what do we have? We had a disclosure statements, detailed memos, a letter from counsel, an amendment, a proposed amendment to the declaration been given to the homeowners. They were given a proposed ballot. They were given other disclosure statements that told them what the right was, who Nohea Kai was, what the conflict of Director Gordon was, the fact that if the lessees acquired all of their interests there was a potential that the association could receive a positive return on the investment. They were told that the board would set the pricing policy. They were told that the board would have the discretion, as it deemed appropriate, as stated in the amendment to the declaration, to set that pricing policy. Based upon all of that information, 60 homeowners representing more than 75% of the common interest pertinent to the property voted in favor. Included in that vote was the percentage of common interest held by appellants. They voted in favor of everything that I just mentioned, including granting the board the authority to set that pricing policy.
The authority to set the pricing policy didn't include approval of the pricing policy itself, did it?
No, Your Honor. It did not include the approval of the exact pricing policy.
And we would assume, too, that approval of the pricing policy would be valid approval of the pricing policy.
That's correct, Your Honor. But at the point in time that the pricing policy came up.
So as far as the amendment is concerned, which the court relied on, the petitioners aren't precluded from challenging the vote itself by voting for the amendment to the declaration.
They are stopped from challenging the vote in this particular case because of the fact that the pricing policy, their objection to the pricing policy is that it creates a profit.
Well, the pricing policy was never in the declaration. Nobody knew what the pricing policy would be.
That is correct.
All that was in the declaration, as you would expect, would be that the board of directors would have power to set the price.
In the declaration, the board of directors had the discretion, as they deemed appropriate, to establish the pricing policy.
And
there was no fixed policy at that moment.
And the underlying assumption is that if the board of directors adopted a pricing policy, that it would have to be one that was validly adopted.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So as far as their vote on the declaration, the vote on the pricing policy and the pricing policy itself had not yet occurred.
That is correct. It was after the declaration had been recorded.
And you've never taken the position that they're foreclosed from challenging the vote itself, have you?
I've taken the position, appellees have taken the position that they are stopped from challenging the fact that the association can sell these lease fee interests to generate a positive return on their investment. Now,
I'm sorry, I just wanted an answer to my question. You have never taken the position that the petitioners are foreclosed from challenging the vote on the pricing policy?
Appellees have taken the position that their interpretation of the bylaws and Robert's Rules of Order is wrong as to the vote on the pricing policy.
Fine, but you have never challenged their right to object to the way the vote was taken.
I would have to disagree with Your Honor. If the appellees are challenging
Where in your briefs do you raise that?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Where in your briefs do you raise that challenge?
The challenge would be on page...
That challenge that they have the right to question the vote.
That they have the right to... Excuse me, Your Honor?
That they have the right to question the validity of the vote.
It would be on page 28 of the answering brief through 30.
Well, which specific sentence? Because I'm sorry, I looked and I didn't see it.
But Your Honor, maybe I'm misunderstanding the court. The appellees have taken the position that the interpretation of the bylaws and disregarding Article 4, Section 11 regarding conflict of directors and Robert's Rules of Order, the interpretation by appellants, is wrong. The vote by the board
was correct. I understand that. My question
is
really simple. Have you at any time challenged the right of the petitioners to attack the validity of the vote on the pricing policy?
In phrased that way, Your Honor, I would say no.
Okay, I agree with you. And, you know, on, in fact, on footnote 36, page 31 of your answering brief, thus as the circuit court held, appellants are estopped from, and you have a whole list, none of which goes to the validity of the vote of the pricing policy. You don't list that. So you've never raised it. You've never raised the fact that the petitioners don't have the right to challenge the validity of the vote.
That would be correct, Your Honor.
Going to the, you know, your interpretation of the Roberts rules, the bylaws say that action by a majority of the directors present at any meeting shall constitute action by the board. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the bylaws also contain the provision that no director shall vote or cast a proxy vote at any board meeting on any matter in which he or she has a conflict of interest.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And when someone abstains, according to Roberts, that's not considered a vote, is it?
Under Roberts, the abstention is treated as a no vote, as
it
cited
has
by
the effect,
appellants.
According to Roberts, of a no vote. Voting requirements, I'm just reading from page 390, section 44. Voting requirements based on the number of members present, a majority of those present, and I'll skip to the next sentence. A majority of those present, while possible, are generally undesirable. Since an abstention in such cases has the same effect as a negative vote, it has the effect, but it's not a vote. These bases deny members the right to maintain a neutral position by abstaining. For the same reason, members present who fail to vote, though indifferent, through indifference rather than through deliberate neutrality, may affect the result negatively. So Roberts realizes that abstention means you don't vote, but the effect is the same as if the person voted no. So that isn't a conflict with conflict of interest provision, is it?
That's correct, Your Honor. I should also note, Your Honor, if you look at appellant's argument regarding the Hawaiian Electric case and treating an abstention as a no vote, technically in that case, this court's decision would have been different. Because in that particular case, there was one abstention of five members of the board of the Department of Land and Natural Resources. And that one abstention, when you had a vote of six members, you had a vote of 3-2. And if you treated that one abstention as a no vote, then you would have had a 4-2 vote and a denial of the applicant's application. In Hawaiian Electric, this court found that because the legislator had created the body and they required all members to vote, that one abstention meant not everybody voted, and so the 3-2 could not have been ineffective, and therefore the default provision on approving the application went forward. So if you adopted appellant's argument, that decision would have been different because that no vote, again, would have been counted as a vote of the entire body. The court is correct, and Justice Acoba is correct, there is a conflict between Article 4, Section 11 of the bylaws regarding conflicted directors and Robert's Rules of Order. And again, Robert's Rules of Order makes it very clear that it is the governing documents of the association that controls in this case.
I guess maybe I misspoke, but my understanding was your bylaws say no director shall vote or cast the proxy vote. And Robert says abstention is not a vote, but it is counted as a no.
Well, that's how appellants are interpreting it, Your Honor, that they're counting the vote as a no vote. If you counted an abstention as a no vote under Roberts Rules of Order and applied it to the conflict provision of the bylaws, technically that conflicted director would be voting on a matter in which he has a conflict with the association.
So you would rather have this bylaw say present and voting in order to sustain
I think it needs to be interpreted, Your Honor, as present and eligible to vote under its provisions.
But it doesn't say present and voting.
No, it does not, Your Honor. It just says present. In addressing the issue regarding Chapter 514C, if you accept appellant's argument that the acquisition of the lease fee interest can only be sold to the lessees and it has to be sold at a prorated cost, it would effectively end lease fee conversions in Hawaii. Homeowners associations would not commit their resources and energy to an investment, and we're dealing with multi-million dollars investments of lease fee interest on behalf of the association, where that endeavor is going to result in financial disaster to the association. At the time the issue of acquiring lease fee interest comes up to the association does not know how many lessees will acquire their interest. In this particular case, we had 68 remaining lease fee interests, technically 68 lessees. At the time the issue came up with the board and presented to the owners, nobody knows how many lessees would acquire their interest. If you set the value of the lease fee interest at its prorated cost, including the carrying costs, to break even, you would have to effectively sell every single one of the lease fee interests. And we know in reality that doesn't happen. So if you accept appellant's argument and you have to sell every single one, for the ones you don't sell, the association would have a negative debt. Well, and who has to finance that debt? The owners.
Well, you, the association knew all these things, right, when it purchased.
That's correct, Your Honor.
It knew what the risks and advantages were.
That's correct, Your Honor.
In fact, the lawyer set out in a letter to every lessee and homeowner what the risks and advantages would be.
That's correct.
And the statute provides that for those lease fee interests that aren't sold, the association can collect lease rent.
That's correct.
And the purchase is spread across everyone, all the owners of the condominium, even those who don't purchase. Everyone is assessed the cost of borrowing $6 million and paying the interest on the loan, et cetera.
That's correct.
So even the petitioners here assess the cost of that.
That is correct.
And if you can't sell to any of the lessees, you can sell under the statute to a third person. Isn't that correct?
That's what the statute provides, Your Honor. However,
and does your declaration provide the same thing?
Yes, Your Honor.
So if you can't find a lessee to buy, then you can sell to a third person who's not a lessee.
That's not appellant's interpretation, Your Honor.
Is that what the statute says?
Yes, but that's not their interpretation of the statute.
Well, I'm just asking you. They're not up here. And so in the meantime, you collect lease rent.
Your Honor, we are talking about a $6.2 million investment.
How many have you sold so far?
We have sold 61 of the 68 lease fee interests.
So you have only seven outstanding?
No, Your Honor. We actually have one.
Oh, only
in
one.
I'm sorry. Let me correct it. We sold 61 of the 68 lease fee interests to the lessees. Six were sold in bulk after providing repeated notices to the lessees that they should buy their interest, that if they did not buy their interest, it would be sold in bulk. So that's six. The one remaining lease fee interest is being held subject to the pending appeal right now that's before the ICA of this companion case, the related case concerning the Kalars. That's the only interest that we are still holding for a remaining lessee of the association.
So now the association has an inventory of one leasehold interest?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So you've been pretty successful then in distributing the lease fee interest, or?
I would say at this point, Your Honor, over the 5 year period, yes, it picked up at the end. I think when the association started informing everybody that if you did not acquire, be sold in bulk, more people purchased. At the time of the motion and the time that we were before the Second Circuit Court, only 42 had bought at that moment in time. In dealing with the issue about what...
Comport with the pricing policy?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Did you comport with the pricing policy that was passed on motion?
Yes, Your Honor.
Board.
The pricing policy has stayed the same as fixed by the board at that time, other than having the periodic adjustments in the price over the last 5 years.
In other words, you haven't been charging the tacking on the 5% a year?
No, that was the policy, Your Honor. So that's the policy that has been in place and has been followed by the board. Yes, Your Honor.
And that was stated in the motion?
Yes, Your Honor. Going back again to
So you pegged the purchase price at the same price that the association acquired the interest from the lessor for. Is that right?
Yes. Adjusted.
And then
for
every year
values.
You added on 5%.
To adjust for current values, yes, Your Honor.
So you had a 25% profit over what you paid for it, the association.
Maybe if that's how the math comes out, Your Honor, yes. I should note, Your Honor, that the use of the term at the time that the board goes to the lessees to buy their interest, the use of the term profit is a misnomer. Because, again, you don't know how many interests are you going to sell. And if you don't know how many interests you're going to sell and you don't sell enough to cover the $6.2 million financing that you now take out, there is no profit.
But the letter from the attorney, association attorney, to everyone said there's potential for profit, using the term profit, at least twice in the letter.
And in the context of the yes, correct, Your Honor. And in the context of that letter, they were talking about selling all of the lease fee interest. In fact, in a report by the lease fee consultant to all the owners, he provided certain scenarios in which how the lease fee interest would be sold and the possibility of what they could generate through the sale. I should note, Your Honor, that in looking at Chapter 514C, and particularly 514C2 and 514C6, what those sections try to do is to strike a balance. How do you facilitate and encourage lease fee conversions in an efficient and economical manner? That's the legislative intent behind Chapter 514C. How do you do that? You need to strike the balance. Justice Okoba is correct that you go to all the owners to get their approval to accept that risk. How do homeowners who own a condo unit decide to accept the risk? That they will accept the risk of a multi-million dollar transaction to invest in. And that's where the statute strikes a balance. And the balance is basically allowing the homeowners association, its board, as approved by owners representing more than 75% of the common interest pertinent to the property, having them approve this process whereby the board can, one, acquire, own, improve, use, or otherwise deal with and in the lease fee interest. That section of 514C6 provides that the board has the authority and all the rights of ownership that come from the acquisition of lease fee interest. At that point in time, they have the right to set the pricing policy to ensure that the owners as a whole benefit. Appellants benefited. All the owners benefited. You know, in dealing with the issue and the labeling of the board as highwaymen or cream skimmers, you know, the statute is very clear. Chapter 514A and 514C in having all the owners look at this issue and decide what's best for the association. The board has certain fiduciary duties. The board has an obligation of good faith. Third-party investors do not. If the board did not acquire this with the approval of all the owners representing 75% of the common interest, including appellant's vote, if they didn't do this, the lease fee interest would have been bought by a third-party investor. There was a second contract with Hawaiian Islands Development Company that was in place for $500,000 more than what the board had acquired the lease fee interest for. So if the board had not acquired these interests, appellants would not have had their interest. None of the 68 lessees would have had their interest. It would have been acquired by that third-party investor. Because if they did not get 75% of the common interest voted in favor, it's that party that would have acquired their interest. Court has any further questions? Thank you very much for the court. Request the court to affirm the decision of the Second Circuit Court and the Intermediate Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Mr. Reeder.
Thank you.
Your Honor, to what counsel just said was, gee, unless these condos can make money off of these things, and by the way, the money from the realtor estimates $3.5 to $4 million, approximately $47,000 per unit for a back-to-back transaction. This is the epitome and exactly what the legislature was trying to avoid. They wanted to create a win-win. Win for you, Mr. Fee owner. You get to sell these things in bulk so you don't have to mess around with a bunch of individual sales. Win for you, homeowners. You get this bulk discounted price. And the legislature says, we don't want cream-skimming middlemen grabbing the bulks and turning them out and selling them for a profit, which is exactly
what $4 million was what the association made over what it paid. Is that what you said?
Yes, over and above. Over and above. And that is what it's not like. And the other thing, too, they're acting like, oh, gosh, it's this big mystery and it's this big risk. It is not true. And the statutes say very clearly what you're supposed to do under 514C22, which is you secured that loan that you needed on those leasehold interest. That's all you have to do. And also the condos, unlike and usually I represent the condos, they're a very unique creature. They've got the power to, in effect, tax. Oh, we don't have enough money? Well, we raise the maintenance fees. But it's not even, it's, this thing was sold to the fee owners as, yes, we tried to grab this for ourselves, Mr. Gordon in Montana. Now, fee owners, we are cutting the rest of you in out. Look, we can make $3.5 to $4 million. They're making that money right away. That's exactly what the legislature didn't want to have happen. And I'm sure that, and if you look at the House Standing Committee report and the Senate Standing Committee report, I think the legislature would be shocked that the people that they intended to be the champions for these homeowners turn out to be the cream-skimming middlemen. That's exactly what happened. With regard to...
You don't have any objection to the acquisition of the interests or the loan or the other conveyances, do you?
No objections whatsoever. The other thing, going back to a couple of points here, the dirty little secret, I guess, problem with this case is that it really is this money is the root of all evil situation. If things were done the way they're supposed to do, which is, hey, lessees, this is all your baby, but you're going to get it, and there's no risk to the association, there would be no reason not for an association to do this on behalf of its lessee owners, because it's all their risk, it's all their problem. And the fee owners do benefit, because when leaseholds, especially when leaseholds are at the end of like a 30-year lease or a 50-year lease, obviously the homeowners start caring a lot less about what their building looks like. It's like, well, I'm going to lose my apartment in a couple of years, so I don't want to invest in painting and cleaning up and doing all these things. And that fact was pointed out by Ms. Neely, the association's attorney. The other thing that's interesting about this case is that these two poor lessee members of the board said, gee, since we're in the situation of buyers here, we feel kind of weird about this, so we're going to vote, we're going to abstain. Because they said, well, we're buyers. The problem is those other five were sellers, and that's why by putting this profit thing in there, and there's a statutory definition of conflict of interest in Hawaii Revised Statutes 514B-125, and it says, 125-F. It says conflict of interest as used in this subsection means an issue in which a director has a direct personal or pecuniary interest not in common to other members of the association. So by turning 75% of these folks into buyers and sellers and 25% of buyers, there is a conflict, and that's the whole problem with the matter is that it never should have happened that way in the first place. They just followed the law. Also, with regard to Mr. Gordon, there is a letter from Ms. Neely, the association's attorney, telling the homeowners that Mr. Gordon has acknowledged a conflict of interest on this issue. And while it's not entirely clear, the ray line for her letter is this purchase of the fee interest. He says he's disclosed it, he's not going to vote on it, then he votes. Council's just conceded that an abstention vote is counted as a no vote, and there is no conflict between the bylaws and Roberts. Bylaws say use Roberts, the statutes say use Roberts. If you don't like what the bylaws say, they can amend the bylaws, but in the meantime, they have to follow them. And I think Justice Acoba hit the nail on the head here. They're saying, well, gosh, what about this risk? This isn't land that's lying there fallow and we don't know what to do with it. They're getting lease rents, so they're either going to get a bunch of money at once or money over time. And I'm sorry, I guess my time is out unless the court has any questions. Thank you very much for your time.
Mr. Revere, we'll leave your Robert rules.
We can donate those to the law library if Your Honor would prefer.
Okay. Why don't you take it downstairs?
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. We'll take this matter under advisement.
Thank you.